But when the babies were a bit up shopless and crying and burping one thing and another, they'd put a couple of teaspoons of whiskey in a saucer, hold a lighted match over it. That was to burn the spirit out, so they said. I don't know, but it might have done. And then they'd give this couple of teaspoons to the baby. And before many minutes, the baby was fast asleep. Of course, it might be in the whiskey itself that was doing it, but it put them off to sleep all right. And if any of you are interested at the present time, this is about 1913, 1914, before the Great War, or World War One, as they call it now. Whiskey then was sixpence a double. Sixpence old money. That's 2.5 pence the present day money. Well, today it's 44 new pence a double, which gives you an idea of the prices. Another thing we got as children, well, not for babies, of course, but as children, was when the nettles were young. People would go out and cut the nettles young and cut the dandelion leaves young, wash them well, and boil them just like a cabbage, and they'd be given to us as a vegetable. It was supposed to clean our blood, so they said. Whether it did or not, I don't know, but we never had much bother. And in fact, to me, they tasted better than cabbage. Of course, I didn't like cabbage when I was a youngster. But that's one of the things they always gave us in the springtime. Another thing was brimstone and treacle, sulfur and treacle, teaspoonful of that. That was another thing supposed to clear our blood. Our blood must want an awful lot clear in those days. Well, I think that's enough about cures for the time. You'll think it's a medical journal I'm compiling. But just before going away from the cures, I must mention too that the animals weren't forgotten. All the farmers and all had cures for animals, and well, my grandfather was a bit of an expert with animals, and he was very often sent for. They gelded their own foals and things like that, and they tended to the calves' births themselves. There's no sending for the vet. In fact, I knew one farmer that could tell to a minute where a cow was going to calve. He'd wake up, say, at 2 o'clock in the morning, get himself dressed and go out to the cow shed, and a few minutes later the calf would be delivered. Well, as I say, the vets were as thin on the ground as doctors. Well, there's only one I knew, and that was Mr. Atkinson. And I think he lived at where the Manor Hotel is now. It was a big private house. And the reason I know him so well is because he ran me dog over. I had an old Scotch and Irish terrier called Nipper. A fellow would sooner fight than have his dinner. And I was going down to the mill one day for groats. The watermill at Gower, which it's there yet, but of course not working. And there was no instant porridge those days. You bought the groats and steamed it for hours and hours. Anyway, Nipper and me were going down to the mill to get a few pound of groats, and the mill corner wasn't any near as wide as it is now, and Mr. Atkinson came round this corner flat out in his old motor car, and Nipper, who'd seen a fight and have his dinner, as I say, he took a dislike to it. He must have thought it was a mulliner's yowl too, and he made a dive at it, and well, he didn't get run over, but by gum, he got knocked for six. Anyway, Mr. Atkinson got me and him in the car and took him up the house and patched his cuts up and gave him something to keep him quiet for a day or two, and Nipper was made comfortable in a box. And as I say, there was no bones broken or anything, but he got an awful hammering, bruised all over, and Nipper lay comfortable in the box for a day or two and gave Mr. Atkinson his due. He came up to see him quite regular for 2 or 3 weeks, but Nipper recovered all right, and Mr. Atkinson never charged a penny for it. I'll say that for him. Well, now a little bit about the charms he had for curing people. I'm back on the cures again, by the sound of it. But they definitely had charms. I've already mentioned Mrs. Fail curing my warts by charms. But they had charms for stopping headaches. In fact, Mrs. Fail could take a headache away from a person in a few minutes. I don't know what she did, but she just said something and looked into her eyes and the headache was gone. And there was cures for stopping blood. My grandfather had that cure. I know that was worked. A certain gentleman, I can't mention any names because there may be descendants alive yet, But this gentleman came rushing out to me grandfather. He was come up from the fishing, and he told him his wife had fallen in the garden and cut her wrist on one of the old-fashioned pop bottles. You remember them with the marble in them, big rough glass. And it was bleeding something shocking. So my grandfather went in, and she was clinging onto her arm there, and he put it flat on the table, put a towel underneath it, put it flat on the table, put his hand over it, said something over it in Manx again, and the blood stopped pumping out. And he said, now just leave it quiet there till the doctor comes. Well, I suppose it'd be a while before Dr. Godson, I think his name was, came up from Laxey in his pony and trap. Mind you, the fast little pony. And anyway, he attended to it and sewed it up, whatever you do. And after that, he went up to me grandfather, offered him 50 golden sovereigns to start with to tell him how he'd done it. Then he offered him 100 golden sovereigns, but of course my grandfather said no, because I believe if you sold the charm, you lost the power of it. I was supposed to get that power for stopping blood, but as I say, I went off to sea about 14 and we sort of lost track then, so I didn't get it. But I think the present day doctors are quite adequate at stopping that blood. I'll give them a word of praise for once anyway. Now then, there was supposed to be a charm for eczema, and I've heard of that being worked, not by my grandfather or Mrs. Fail, but I heard of that being worked by another old Manxman, an old fellow named Walter Moore. He's dead and gone long since too, oh, many years. He hoped he'd lived to be the oldest inhabitant of London, but he didn't at all. Somebody beat him by 3 years, and I'll bet if he's listened to this now, he'd be as mad as the devil about it. Now this charm for stopping blood. This was one that was exercised by my grandfather again, but this time on an animal. It happened on a farm. I can't quite remember the name of the farm. It might have been Ballaskerra or it might be Ballacoa. But there was a man working there. Well, he was a lad of 13 then. Of course, they took him from the school at 13 then, and they went on the farms. And this man is alive to this day, although he's much older than me, but I'm pleased to see he's still alive and to the fore. But anyway, a cow had calved. It might have been a heifer, it might have been her first calf, I don't know, but anyway, the cow had calved, and the delivery had all been perfect, but the cow started hemorrhaging, and the farmer got worried. Run, Tommy, he says, for old Johnny Kelly Pat, and be as quick as you can and tell him what's happened. Well, Tommy set off, as I say, a lad of 13. It'd take him 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour to get there, I suppose. And meantime, the cow was still hemorrhaging a bit. And the farmer got a bit anxious, looked at his watch. He says, Tommy should be there by now. Well, a couple of seconds later, the hemorrhage stopped at the cow, and she's washed off, and all right. Calf was put to her and everything was all right. So anyway, a bit later, Tommy came back, and the farmer said to him, is he coming? So Tommy said, no, he's not coming at all, but he did something a bit queer, what I thought. What did he do, said the farmer? Took his hat off, he says, put his hand on my shoulder, said something in Manx, and said, go back now, boy. He says, the cow is quite all right again. Well, that actually happened, and this man could verify it to this day. So, I don't know, they say there's something in charms. There must be. There must have been something those days. Of course, I believe at the present moment there's a man alive in this town, and he's not much older than myself. And I hear he has the charm for stopping blood. I can't give you his name, because I wouldn't like to do that. I would not without his permission, because I haven't seen him for 4 or 5 years. But those charms for most things, you know. And then another thing they did, they wore things to prevent illnesses and things. For example, to prevent lumbago, they'd wear a G-string of a violin, or fiddle as they called it then, around their waist. Of course, the strings then, I suppose, were made of catgut, not this present-day stuff what they make, with man-made fibres and all this kind of thing. But they used to wear this G-string round their waist all winter. And I often think to myself now and laugh to myself about it. I wonder, was the origination of the G-string they talk about in these clip joints? It might have been, you know. Another thing that was supposed to stop lumbago was carry a nutmeg around in your pocket, in your back pocket, all the winter. I don't know whether it did any good or not, but there's scores of people used to carry one with them. And for rheumatism, a bit of copper of some kind, a thin copper sheath, sewed into your belt. You know, the leather belt with a bit of thin copper sewed into it, into the back of it. That was supposed to prevent rheumatism. And red flannel, oh my word, that was used by the scores of yards for everything. Inside the men's singlets, a piece sewn, and all this kind of thing. And anywhere you had a pain, there was red flannel put on it. Where would you buy red flannel now? I wouldn't like to think. It'd be practically impossible, I think. It's bad enough to buy a bit of cotton stuff now, never mind red flannel. Well, as I said, there was charms for a lot of things, but of course I couldn't remember the half of them. But they really did work, you know. There was something in them. No matter what any skeptics say nowadays, there's something in them. So now, well, we leave the charms alone and go on to the superstitions. Well, psychiatrists tell us that superstition is a weakness. Now, what they mean by that, I don't know, because psychiatrists usually deal with the mind. But where there's a weakness of mind or body, I wouldn't like to say. But I won't say that any of the Manx people are weak either in mind or body, because my grandfather was one of the most superstitious men I knew, and yet he could lecture a couple of hours on the habits of birds, our local birds, fishes, everything around the coastline, all wildlife. And in fact, at one time he was invited to Liverpool University to give a lecture, which he did for 2 hours and answered questions without a note or anything like that, for the simple reason that man could neither read nor write, but yet, as I say, he could stand up there and lecture. So there couldn't have been any weakness of mind there. And I'm certain there was no weakness of body. He was as strong as an ox up to the time he died. Of course, I suppose I'm a bit superstitious too. I'm bound to get that. I inherited from the family, and then I was born on Friday, March the 13th, so I've got a bit of an excuse. But they had superstitions about witchcraft and things like that. And lots of women round about the place were supposed to possess powers of witchcraft. Whether for evil or for good, I don't know, but some were supposed to have the evil eye. Some were supposed to be good witches. But I know there's one or two instances that have happened that animals have proved that these people, there was something wrong with them. Not wrong physically, mentally, or anything like that, but I remember a friend of the family, and whose daughters are still friends of mine. He kept the Craignavar Hotel, or the Keppel Hotel as it's really called. That was Mr. Albert Gill. Now, he had a pony named Daisy on a trap. Well, he put Daisy in the trap, and he might go to set off along the back road, the old 5½ road to Laxey. But if there's a certain woman on that road, and she might be 2 miles away, Daisy wouldn't go along that road, and nothing would shift her. In fact, she put Mr. Gill and the trap over the hedge one time, backed him over the hedge. She would not go along that road, although she couldn't see the woman. This may sound a bit far-fetched, but I know Mr. Gill's daughters would verify this to this day. Another instance I can give you of animal instinct. Well, my father and I were out hunting. I was in Inipra, of course, up round by Honus Quarry. Well, the dog, or rather a bitch it was, and my grandfather's a bitch named Kate, a good hunting dog, put a hare up suddenly. Well, my father took a snapshot out, and fluff come off the hare's leg, but it carried on. And strange it may seem, the dog didn't go after it, she just sat down, which was well away from her usual instinct. Of course, my father and I ran round Croncagara after it, to see if we'd, you know, catch up with it, or if we'd wounded it badly. We got round by Honus Kirk there, and we met a woman coming toward us. A certain woman, I don't mention names, of course, who had a reputation of having the evil eye, and her leg was all bleeding. My father asked her what had happened. She said she caught on some barbed wire. Well, I don't suppose it was barbed wire within a mile and a half radius of where we were, but the dog cowered behind us while we were talking to this woman. So what did that dog know? You tell me, I can't tell you. The one thing I can tell you for certain is that my father never lifted a gun to a hare in his life after that. This is one little point I should just clear up there. I said my grandfather could neither read nor write. Well, that was quite true. But he learned to read and write when he was nearly 60. He was taught very patiently by a younger cousin of mine, whom he and my grandmother had read since she was almost a baby. And he got a lot of pleasure out of his reading in his latter days. So that's cleared up. Let's go on to superstitions now. Well, the hare originated some superstition somewhere. I don't know how, but it must have been the old medieval days when a woman was supposed to be able to turn herself into a hare and escape from her pursuers if she was a witch, or when they were used to roll them down through well in the spiked battle. But when the farmers were cutting corn, you know, of course the rabbits and all stupid, they keep going to the middle of the field, and the lads from Bildrine used to come round with their 12 boars. They were never allowed to bring a dog on the field, and as the corn got smaller and smaller, rabbits would bolt out of it, and of course they could take a shot at them. Rabbits were very good food those days, you know, and they often got quite a few rabbits. But if a hare bolted out, God help the man that lifted his gun to it. Any man that lifted his gun to a hare coming out of the corn would never go on that farm to shoot again. There was another certain woman. She lived on Bildrine Hill, who was supposed to have the evil eye. And I know she used to come down to Garrick Beach at low water to gather flitters and winkles. Well, flitters to English people are limpets, off the rocks. Now, my grandfather would never put the boat to sea, no matter how the pots could rot in the sea or the nets could stop where they were. He would never put the boat to sea till the tide had flowed over where she'd been. Oh, no, never. And I don't know, she may have carried the evil eye on to me, because even when I was almost grown up, in the 1617 region, I had a little cotton 1923 model. Quite a fast little job, nice little thing. Very proud of it, you know. But if I passed her on Bildrine Hill, of course it might have been coincidence. But before I'd gone less than a mile, I'd have something wrong. Mag timing gone, broken chain, a puncture. Of course it could, as I say, all have been coincidence. But I've seen me coming along by Garrick Stores there, and I've seen her on the hill, and I've turned the bike up the old Clovenstone Road to go home. I suppose the superstition is inherent, but I used to think she'd carry the evil eye onto me after my grandfather was gone. Another thing they were superstitious about was meeting a nun. Now, I've known farmers coming down with their produce, maybe to go to market or go on a journey somewhere in the horse and cart or horse and float, maybe coming down a mile, mile and a half down to the main road, and they'd meet a nun on the main road. Do you know, I've known those men turn back, right back to their own yard, and then start all over again. And some people are a bit superstitious over meeting a parson, but my grandfather never was. Himself and Canon John Quine, M.A., Vicar of Longan, one of the most learned men about the place that time, I think. Him and my grandfather were very great friends. In fact, Canon Quine used to come down and bless the nets and pots and things and the gear and the boat before the fishing season started. And him and my grandfather would sit for hours talking in the Manx, natural Manx. I often wish I'd learned it when I had the chance. I might have had a good job now. But they were superstitious over a nun. And as I say, would turn back. A bit stupid, I think, but they used to do it. Another thing they had was the Cairn Cross. That's Rowan or Mountain Ash, to anybody that doesn't know what Cairn is in Manx. And they'd have a cross of this made behind the door to keep the evil spirits out. And if they thought the evil eye was on them, they'd go and sweep the dust off the crossroads and wrap it up in a paper and then burn it on the fire. haven't much time left on this tape, so perhaps you'd better leave the superstitions alone now, and I'll tell you a few of the customs. Now, a funeral was a big thing in the village. A lot of respect was shown, and I'm sure every man in the village took a half day off for a funeral, although in many cases he could ill afford it. Now, motor hearses and that kind of thing were unknown, of course, and 9 cases out of 10, I think the coffins were carried from the house to the church by about 8 young men of the village, strong young men, who would take turns about, and before they left the house, the parson was there always, of course, and a small service was held outside the house, and then the cortege was set off, and I've seen young men carrying the coffin from Baldrine to Lonnon New Church or to Lonnon Old Church, with the parson walking in front a matter of 2 or 3 miles, and 9 cases out of 10 that parson was Canon Quine, and he was no young man then. But every man, as I say, took a day off for the funeral, a half day off, I should say, for the funeral. And everybody wore a dark suit and a bowler hat. And the 4 bearers that were carrying the coffin would carry their bowler hats in their hand while they were acting as bearers. I remember very vividly 8 young men of the village carrying a coffin from the foot of Baldrine Hill to Lonnon Old Church. And what strikes me most is 4 of those young men never came back from World War I, including my youngest uncle. Weddings. Well, in lots of cases, the wedding party would be held at night. And the Sunday school, which acted as the village hall as well, was hired. And there was plenty to eat. Nothing to drink, of course, but plenty to eat. Ham, bannock, griddle cake, Manx butter, plenty of tea, and it was free for all. Anybody in the village could go. My word, good times are had by them too. And then there was the usual tea fights, as we used to call them, at the Sunday school. Every other week there'd be a tea party of some kind, and a social in the evening. And there was also the what they call the bachelor's tea party. That was when all the young men of the village, all the bachelors, prepared everything and did all the waiting on. Oh, a great time this had to be all, and was very often a concert or a social after it. And of course then there was the melia, that was the harvest supper. When the farmers had their harvest all in, I got makes my mouth water to think of it. Just for example, on one farm alone, Bruce, I've seen there the harvest supper with the table grown in the stuff. Oh, 8 or 10 roast rabbits all cut up into bits. 3 or 4 chickens, all roasted and cut up. A crock of hard-boiled eggs, maybe a couple of score in it, all shelled. And slices and slices and slices of home-cured bacon. Cold, of course. As much bunny or griddle cake as you could eat. A couple of pins of bitter and a couple of pins of mild for the men. And, well, the women if they wanted it too, but there was always a big urn of tea on the hob, and you just got yourself a rosy basin off the dresser. By the way, that same dresser, if anybody's interested, is in the Manx Museum yet, given by Mr. and Mrs. Robert Fayle of the Grange Farm, the son and daughter-in-law of the Fayles of Bruce. Well, you just got a rosy basin, filled yourself a cup of tea. It wasn't a cup, of course, then it was a rosy basin, as I say. But everybody mucked in, and there was not much in the way of entertainment except a piano or maybe a gramophone, the old gramophone with the horn on, with the dog sitting there, his master's voice. Of course, there was no tin entertainment those days like there is now. Of course, not all the farmers give these melias, you know, these harvest suppers. Some of them are too mean to give you a drinkable milk.
Of course, it wasn't only the farmers that had the melia, you know. My grandfather always gave a melia at the end of the fishing season. Well, there was a few fellows used to help him when we were seine netting or anything like that, because when you were seine netting, of course, it took about 3 men on the end of each rope, because 440 yards of net with a big cod end to it took a lot of drawing in from about 600 yards out. And I only had a crew of 2 beside himself, and And me, of course, I was in a nipper of nine then. I was tailing on the end of the rope and coiling it, and there was another young fella, a cousin of mine, used to come and tail on the end of the other rope, and we used to shout the marks out. Well, these men that helped them, sometimes it'd be midnight when we were seine netting, they all depend on the tide. These men and their wives and all, they were invited too, and I might as well tell you that's the only time in the whole fishing season we ever tasted a bit of salmon or lobster, because they were too valuable for the common herd to have during the season. But there was the usual thing, bacon and sausage and lobster and a bit of salmon, as much crab as you could eat, and bonnig and girdle cake and ale for the men and the women if they wanted to, and usually a tot or two of whiskey or rum for the older men, and home-brewed lemonade or ginger beer for us youngsters, and a good time was had by all of them. Anyway, I don't know, in this playback you might have heard the fire crackling a bit. This is by the way, of course. Well, I've got a good fire on them, I tell you. Lord, it's May the 8th, and I said earlier on, but the season's changing. Well, I've just been out to get a bit of coal, and my word, it's blowing a howl nor'easter, and it's quite cold out. Now, Sunday in those days really was the Sabbath day. You never saw a man out digging in his garden or clipping his fences. The only men that did a bit of work were the farmers, and of course they had to. They had to milk their cattle and feed their stock, but they were the only men that ever did any work on a Sunday. But it was a day for socialising. You know, the men would go out in the morning, well, reasonably well dressed. It was a fine morning, and you'd see a gang of them sitting at the top of the harbour road, all smoking their pipes and having a yarn about what had happened during the week. And then, of course, the youngsters had to go to Sunday school. I'm saying had to. We didn't question it, really. We went in the morning, we went in the afternoon, and then we went to chapel in the evening. Well, there was always a good congregation at the chapel. Then when the service would be over, they'd gather in little groups and have a yarn, maybe sit on a hedge or lean over a gate, or maybe a gang of them go for a walk along the main road. And of course, those days you could walk six abreast along the main road without the risk of being mowed down. Now if you go to walk along the main road, you've only got to walk in single file. And then they'd go back to each other's houses for a yarn and a bit of supper. I've seen three or four people back at our house on a Sunday night for supper, and supper then days would be a slice of roast beef and some pickles, or maybe some pickled cabbage, and a bit of griddle cake, or bread and butter, a cup of tea, and then next Sunday maybe we'd go to one of their houses for supper, and so on. And then the minister, it might be a reverend, it might be a local preacher, they'd always be invited back to somebody's house for supper. People were very sociable then, some way. Nowadays, you're almost afraid to call at anybody's house on the hop in the evening for fear of interrupting their television programs. Don't think I'm knocking television, mind you, I'm not. Television's a very wonderful media which has enabled people to see things that they'd never have seen in a lifetime. I mean, cup finals, royal weddings, coronations, things like that, they could never have lived to see them if they'd lived to be 100. But, to me, I think it has spoiled the art of conversation, which used to exist. I may be wrong, of course, but that's just my very humble opinion. However, I think I haven't got much time left now. At least I've got time, but I don't think the tape has. So, I hope you've enjoyed it, and maybe I'll think on 101 more things after this tape is finished, and perhaps make another. But in 50 years' time, maybe somebody will listen to this and say, well, that must have been the Manx dialect of those days. I'm afraid, though, in 50 years' time, the old Manx dialect will be gone completely, because even now I meet fellas I went to school with, fellas of my own age, and instead of saying Castletown as it's spelt, they say Castletown. Instead of saying Derby Haven, they say Derby Haven. I don't know whether they're ashamed of their dialect or not, but thank God I'm not. Well, as I said, I'm approaching the end of this tape. I hope some of you enjoyed listening to it, because I've enjoyed making it, you know. and hope someday to make another. So, for the time, this is the oldest of the Kelly-Patines clan, saying to you all, lay my, and thank you very much for listening.